you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to another episode of Kotaku Split Screen. It is July 28th, 2016. Today we have a Q&A episode. We are reaching into our mailbags and pulling out some reader questions, which means we're going to talk about lots and lots of things. Some Overwatch, some Destiny, we're going to talk about the new consoles, NX, Neo, Scorpio. Maybe we will get into some YouTube controversies, and we will talk about what it is really like to write reviews of video games. Thank you, as always, for listening to Split Screen. This will be a fun one. Here we go. Are back. Hi, Kirk.
Hi, Jason. How's it going?
Good. Are you ready for a very special mailbag episode of Kotaku Split Screen?
I'm ready. I'm picturing us both with mailbags like Santa Claus over our shoulders, full of...
with giant sacks.
Yes. Physical envelopes just full of mail, falling everywhere with addresses like, written on them.
Yeah, that icon that you see, like the email icon, is just stamped on them on the bags, and we're just carrying them around everywhere.
Yes, exactly.
This is the mailbag episode. We took a lot of questions and have been hoarding a lot of questions from previous weeks and months, and we will try to crank through as many of them as possible. Should we just get started?
Yeah, should we just do like let's do like one word answers to every single one. Yes,
to every single one. Up front, we should say if you want to send us questions for future shows, you can reach us at splitscreen@kotaku.com. We read every single question. We don't read all of them on the show, but we will try to read the really good ones. You can also send us stories, interesting observations.
Yeah,
thoughts.
I would say that I'd love to just, if you have a cool story or a cool thing that happened to you, like we'll, and it's good, like we'll totally read it on the show, even if you don't have a question. Like it doesn't have to be, you know, what are you guys wearing or what's your favorite sandwich? Like it can just be, here's a crazy thing that happened to me in whatever game.
If you ask us what we're wearing or what our favorite sandwiches are, we would probably not read that on the show.
I'll happily talk about my favorite sandwiches on this show anytime.
Kirk, don't, you're going to encourage people.
We're just going to get stuck talking about sandwiches.
We can
do a sandwich episode. We are also a snack food website in addition to being a gaming website.
Okay, let's get started. So first up, we have an email from Jihad in Saudi Arabia. Hi, Jihad. That's really cool. We have listeners in Saudi Arabia. He has a few questions. We'll answer a couple of them. First one is easy. When do you think the next Red Dead will be released? I predict it will be May 2018 at the least. That's what he says. I disagree. Do you disagree?
Yeah. I think 2018 is too far out.
Yeah. I think spring 2017.
Yes. That would say, like, May seems like a good month. And May is kind of always when that, for some reason, I associate Rockstar games and Naughty Dog games with one another.
With May? Yeah. Well, and, so Rockstar, yeah, they had, the first Red Dead was a May game, right? Mm-hmm. And L.A. Noire was a May game.
Mm-hmm.
Max Payne, I think, was a May game. GTA was a September game.
Right. That was kind of the fall exception. Yeah. I think GTA 4 also, actually, now I'm forgetting. I'm gonna look it up while we talk.
Okay, but yeah, I would say May 2017. I would say they announce it at some point in the next few months for release in April or May of next year, because I think it's been in development for a very long time.
I think they might announce it and then they might it might get like one kind of moderate delay, like a month or two. But I don't think 2018 just seems too far out. Rockstar is ready to release a major game, and it's going to be that one.
And that is their next game.
Oh, GTA 4, April 29th, 2008.
Oh, so it
almost
is. Okay,
almost
yeah.
May. It'll, yeah, so I think May of next year.
And one more question from Jihad. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, Jihad. How long will Sony support PS Vita's software? Well, Sony stopped supporting PS Vita's. As far as games, they stopped supporting it a long time ago. As far as like the OS and like the keeping the store active and stuff like that.
Yeah, I would guess that's kind of the question too. Since
yeah, it's sort of I think that'll be at least another few years. I don't see them like totally screwing over Vita owners and being like, yeah, we're not going to run the store anymore.
I do wonder about that. I mean, I guess if at some point they just update, I mean, if they stop making as much money on anybody owning a Vita buying a game on the store and it starts costing them more to run that, like there is going to come a point, right, at which they'll just be like, okay, sure. Vita store doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, but at least right now, there are still games, third-party games, coming Vita.
Of course.
So it's not going to be anytime soon.
And there are still
I can see them doing that in like 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are still people just buying even like Killzone or Persona 4 Golden or whatever, like buying new Vita games from the store, which they get some of.
Yeah, 100%.
I hope that doesn't happen. Or if it does happen, I hope the Vita just keeps working as intended. I mean, that would really suck, huh? Because if the store goes down, you can't re-download the games that you already own. I guess that will happen. I'm trying to think whether that's happened with past handhelds or not.
Yeah, well, the PSP's store.
All those games I think are still around, like the PSP games.
No, well, you can get the PSP games on your Vita. I'm not sure if you can log in on your PSP right now. And yeah, I know in Europe or in Japan it was. I don't know. I'm not 100% sure off the top of my head what they did with that. The PS3 store is still active, and that's kind of a legacy hardware now. So that's a good sign. Yeah, I don't know. It's hopefully as long as possible.
So that's our answer, is hopefully for a while, we both like the Vita and don't want it to become less useful.
You want to do the next question?
Oh, yeah. All right. This is Joey. We have a listener, Joey, says, "Hey, Jason and Kirk, my question is, what other franchise could you see doing a Pokemon Go-style game? Also, who are you guys maining in Overwatch lately?"
You're excited for that.
I'm excited for both, actually, because I have a whole answer to that first question. Let's do them in order, though. So, in terms of other franchises that we could see doing a Pokemon Go game, I think I maybe even mentioned this on the podcast, maybe not, like really in passing last week. But I think, and I'm sure everybody has their own favorite thing for this, but I think that a Ghostbusters Pokemon Go game would be really cool. I've seen a few people say this, like on Twitter and online. And it seems like it would work really well, right? You can picture it. You have a little PKE meter on your phone that you walk around, and it detects ghosts as you get closer. And then it projects the ghosts into AR, and you like bust it and put it in a trap. And maybe there's big ghosts that appear in certain places that people have to team up to take down.
Pokemon Go is such a broken and busted game that I wouldn't really want it on. Other franchises.
You know, the concept, though, not the execution. Like the idea of a game where you go out and do stuff in the real world and like catch things or find things.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, Ghostbusters, yeah, it could work well with that, although I think they missed the boat as far as timing since the movie is already out.
But also, like, Ghostbusters is going to be popular forever. And
do you think it's big enough?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Especially, like, among the sorts of people who would want to play a, you know, AR game. I don't think it would be as big as Pokemon Go. Like, it doesn't have...
No, well, nothing will be as big as Pokemon Go.
Yeah, it's just not as perfectly designed. Like, people don't know Ghostbusters ghosts. Like, everyone knows... Well, some people know a Class 5 full-roaming vapor, which is Slimer. But I don't think people know whatever the other, like all the other terminology they're saying in the new movie where they're like, that's a class 4, like half torso apparition. Like, I don't think people are like, oh, sweet, I finally got a half torso apparition or anything like that. Like, I think.
I can't think of any franchises that people would know as many creatures as Pokemon. What if it was like a real life thing where you had to like go and find real types of animals, birds and like whales and shit?
That would probably get ugly and potentially legally problematic.
Actually,
faster.
Instead of the thing, this isn't quite the answer. An answer to the question that Joey asked, but I would like to see a Pokemon Snap game. I think that would be a lot more interesting than Pokemon
fun.
Go. Like, you find Pokemon in the wild, and then you have to take pictures of them, and like you get rated based on how good your picture is.
I could see them actually taking Pokemon Go and you can take pictures of the Pokemon in Pokemon Go. So it's already like they have the tools there to do that. I liked Pokemon Snap. I never played Pokemon games, but some of my friends when I was first in college had that game and everyone would play it.
It was great.
And it was pretty fun. Yeah, I have like fond memories of that game.
Yeah, it was really cool. Okay, so as for the second question, I am maining Tracer in Overwatch. Even though I suck at Overwatch. Man, why am I so bad at Overwatch?
You just need to play more.
But I don't have the time to play more. I just want to be instantly good at it.
But that's why you're not good yet.
Well, but it's like, it feels to me like I'm not enjoying it, and I won't enjoy it until I'm really good at it, but I don't have the time to put in the hours that I would need to be really good at it, so it's like a catch-22.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a very common problem with any competitive multiplayer game, is that, I mean...
What are you meaning, D.Va?
Yeah, these days I'm meaning D.Va. Wait, I want to talk to you about Tracer, because I love Tracer, and then we can talk about D.Va. But
okay,
what are your thoughts on playing Tracer?
I like her. I like her. I like the idea of like teleporting around and skirmishing with people and trying to catch people from behind. But I don't know. I just don't have the like muscle memory for all of her abilities, and like I don't have the sense of what characters do what exactly. Like I still don't know all the characters and what the hard counters are. Like I kept getting stuck by McCree's flashbang, the stun grenade that stuck me in place, which I guess is a hard counter to Tracer. So, like, situationally, even though in theory I would love Overwatch as a game that I can play for, like 30 minutes once in a while every couple of weeks with my friends, and it's like, hey, let's go play some Overwatch, I don't feel like I can do that because you have to know it so well to be good at it. And that's not to say it's a bad game, because it's a fantastic game. I just personally don't have the time for it.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I mean, you would, of course, be welcome to play with our group anytime, and you'd learn it pretty fast. Like, I found...
No, I know. I just have so much other stuff to play.
It was partly actually playing with our group. Some people, I think, like Phil Hornishaw, had some really good tips. When I was first starting out, just I'd pick a new character and say, all right, I'm going to play Lucio. I don't know who this guy is. I just started.
Yeah.
And he would immediately be like, oh, well, like, remap your button here and, like, think about doing this and know you can do this on this map. And it was actually very helpful to have that. But... yeah, I think the things you're going to need to know, like just using Tracer as a specific, but this is true of every character, is sort of you need to know the maps pretty well. I find that especially playing Tracer and D.Va, who's similar to Tracer actually, especially now, they're both kind of characters that you really want to be able to escape any situation that you're in. So you want to kind of, you know, Tracer obviously moves super fast, so you want to like sneak around through a side alley and then pop out behind them and like kill their Mercy and then like zoom away right when their Reaper starts coming at you. And it kind of takes both knowing how to do that, you know, just in the map, like knowing, okay, like this alleyway is here and that gives me this chance to go there. And also like having the routes kind of planned out in your head, because...
Yeah, it's funny you mention that, because I kept finding myself in situations where I wouldn't know where to go, or like I would turn and try to flank someone and then wind up hitting a dead end.
Right. It's definitely like the difference between a Tracer who knows the level and doesn't is like a Tracer who knows the level can like turn the whole match around just by
being
so annoying.
How many levels are there?
Not that many. What's kind of nice actually is like, especially the escort levels, which I find Tracer is best for, rather than Capture the Flag or King of the Hill. But so there's that, and then the other thing you were saying also is like not knowing which character is a hard counter, and like, or even like which character you kind of shouldn't fuck with. Like,
well, now I know that McCree is a hard counter.
Right, which is definitely good to know. Like Reaper also is like a really tough guy to fight as Tracer, just because he's a little Tracer-ish. Like he has that ability to go ghost form and like get away from you if you're kind of working him over from mid range. But if he gets close to you, he'll kill you really fast as Tracer because you're pretty squishy. So then it's just kind of like figuring out, you're like, okay, like I can shoot this tank, but also if you see a Roadhog, you know the Roadhog is going to immediately be like, I really, really want to get you with my hook. So then you can kind of bait the Roadhog and be like, so you stick your head out and you're like, hey, buddy, and then you hide because you know he's going to waste his hook. And then he needs like 5 seconds. So there's like, that's the kind of advance, like knowing what you're up against. Or every, like Tracer's really good for killing Mercy, I find, because you come around and their Mercy is kind of back there healing their tank, and you come up from the side and you're just like, what's up? The other thing I really like about Tracer that I'm actually also finding with D.Va, which is sort of funny, is that you can just straight up walk up to people from behind them and they just will have no idea you're there. Like I used to start shooting too early. I'd be like, oh, there they are. They're not looking at me. Better start shooting. And now I'll just walk up because there's nobody. They're all looking.
Yeah, because there's no radar.
Right, and there's no radar, and they're all looking.
Yeah, that's something
your
I don't think about since I'm so used to Destiny's PvP.
Exactly.
I think about the radar a lot.
Yeah, I actually played a little bit of Destiny, which we'll maybe talk about a little down the road. And I was like, I completely had forgotten about the radar, and I was just running around, and then I was like, oh right, there's
that's
a radar.
So funny.
That's
funny.
It's a
huge
difference.
Yeah, that's because it's such an interesting contrast. Yeah, we've been talking about, we'll get to that in a little bit. I think we have a Destiny question or two, but there are a lot of interesting compare and contrast. You should do an article, Destiny versus Overwatch, the comparison we
like
have
Destiny
to make.
Crucible versus Overwatch. That'd be, I guess it would be a comparison I have to make because I've played so much of those two, but I feel like there's just as many valid comparisons between.
Well, but I feel like part
FPS.
Of the point of the comparison you had to make is that like we don't actually have to make
Right. Yes, of course. Well, no, I mean, sometimes it's like actually like Oculus Rift versus HTC Vive. Like that's like actually a comparison everyone is making. But yeah, there are times where it's just like, or like that we just kind of wanted to make. It depends. Well, so quickly on D.Va, because I wrote an article about this week, and I've been maining D.Va all week, who is awesome.
Yeah,
now.
I saw your gif of you just like demolishing an entire enemy team. That was awesome.
Yeah, I got
and
my
she's
first
like,
team
nerf
kill.
This, and I'm like, I feel like they kind of have to.
That was my joke in my, I think my tag on my D.Va article was nerf this. Please do not nerf this. D.Va is way better now because they buffed her. So to listeners who, probably, if you play, you probably know the extent of the buff. But if you haven't played since they buffed her, like late last week, at least on consoles, they just changed up the way she works. So D.Va is like in a mech suit, and she has this forward-facing shield that can block incoming fire and boosters, so she can fly around. And her guns are like kind of weak, but they're okay at close range. And it turns her into this kind of really cool, really annoying mix of like Tracer and. A little bit of like Reinhardt. Maybe she's like a cool mix of like having a shield and the ability to block people, like having jet boosters that let her escape tough situations quickly, but also like being tough and having a lot of armor and being able to tank up briefly if she really needs to. And then also you get that extra life when you pop out.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
which
that's
is
so
like,
annoying.
So
when I'm killing a D.Va, it's such a pain in the ass because you're like, yeah, I killed her, and then she just pops out of the armor.
What's also really funny about that I've found, because I've played her a ton over the last like 3 or 4 days, is speaking of like player attention and like where people are looking and where they aren't looking, since so much of D.Va and Tracer I find is actually not about like taking control points or moving the objective forward, it's more about like going up to the side and getting up high and like fucking with the enemy team. It's kind of hilarious the ways that like people just cannot help themselves. Like once they start shooting you, they just can't, and they just chase you forever, even though your team is over there winning. And they're just like, it's really great, a really great feeling when like three people finally kill you, and you're like, you guys, like all three of you are here doing this, like while my team is off like winning. And a funny thing about D.Va I find is that when someone blows up your suit, like every single like anyone looking at you will immediately like start trying to kill you, like in your little, you know, like out of mech self. So you can just run away and they'll just chase you because people are like, oh man, I'm going to get her. And then they like start chasing, and it's super funny. Just
does it count as a kill if you just get a D.Va suit?
Yeah, you get a kill. I'm not sure what the points are or whatever, but you get a like a thing that's like eliminated so-and-so's mech, and then you get eliminated so-and-so if you actually kill D.Va.
So you get two kills like for the actual tracking of kills?
Yeah, I would imagine so. I believe any eliminated thing that pops up on screen gets you that. But So I've been having a lot of fun as D.Va. I think some people are saying she was buffed a little too hard and needs a nerf. I'm of two minds on that. I think maybe she's just competitive now and everyone's figuring out how to counter her.
Yeah.
Like I think that even like playing yesterday compared to playing on Saturday, I felt a little more countered. Like I felt like more people have figured out how to fight the new D.Va, and I'm not totally sure she needs a nerf. The one thing that maybe could be nerfed is her ultimate a little bit, like they could just slow down the charge on that a bit, because it feels like I get it
well,
like
four or five times. Well, you
shouldn't
get your armor back right away.
Oh, you definitely should. I think that it used to be, I think there used to be more of a delay, and it took longer for it to explode. And the worst thing about it is it used to kill you, like if you were within proximity, which is, it just made it way shittier. Like it was just not at all useful. Like compared to ults like Reaper's ult or like Junkrat's ult, like, you know, the other characters are really powerful. So the fact that D.Va is just really powerful now doesn't mean that much, because she just kind of matches you know, like, she matches whoever, like, she matches some of the best characters in the game, which is fine. So I don't know. I think they might do a minor nerf, but but I'm okay. I'm just gonna enjoy it while it lasts.
Okay. Instead of just talking about Overwatch for the rest of the episode,
let's do a couple more questions. Let's keep going. Okay, you got the next one?
Yeah. Okay. So Eric writes, "Hey guys, assuming we had an SNES mini classic to go in part with the NES classic that was announced last year, how many / which games would you guess would be on it?" So I would assume it would be 30, matching the NES classic. It would be harder to narrow down because there are a lot more great Super Nintendo games than there are regular Nintendo games. Kirk, you didn't play much SNES growing up, but I'm sure you have a few thoughts. What do you think? What games would you think would be on there?
I mean, I think you. I have fewer guesses than you probably would, but I don't like what. So
the classics are like Super Mario World, Metroid,
right.
Chrono Trigger, Final Fantasy VI / III.
Street Fighter, maybe. Wasn't Street Fighter 2 the big SNES game?
Of course.
I think that was the game I played the most on SNES.
That was huge. That was the first like big multi-platform console war game because the big argument was Genesis versus Super Nintendo.
Okay, I'm looking at a list. I'm cheating since I didn't have one. I think that's allowed.
Okay, I'm gonna think of some off the top of my head.
Looking at a list of the best SNES games. Oh, but it sucks.
So Super Mario World, Mario Kart.
Yeah, Mario Kart, definitely.
So Chrono Trigger, maybe like Yoshi's Island, although that game is kind of polarizing to people. Maybe Castlevania 4, that game is pretty iconic. I would put Link to the Past on there, Zelda Link to the Past. I would put, there are a few obscure RPGs or more obscure RPGs that I would put on there, but also some bigger ones are like Super Mario RPG, maybe some Earthbound action. I would put Illusion of Gaia on there because that's a pretty incredible game, even though I don't know if Nintendo could. It's never been on the Virtual Console, so I don't know if they even have the license to it. What else? Are there any other big games on the list?
Did you say Donkey Kong Country? I remember that as being
Donkey Kong Country.
SNES game. Maybe Aladdin. We could put Aladdin out there, and then everyone could play that again to try to determine if it's better than the Genesis version.
I don't know. I feel like that game is more beloved because of nostalgia than actual.
Or maybe like literally quality. Because it was a console war game. Like I think that's maybe why people remember it. But I'm kind of interested in that game just because I've always thought that.
Yeah, it's just a platformer. It's like an action platformer.
Yeah.
So I said Super Mario RPG. Mm-hmm. There's definitely some other like really good RPGs I'm forgetting. I would put Lufia 2 on there. That's one of the greatest RPGs ever released. Secret of Mana should be on there. What else? Are there any other classics on your list that
I'm looking at the list? No, it's just a list like a Google thing. They say
Super Mario All Stars.
Oh,
maybe.
Zombies Ate My Neighbors. Wow, I hadn't thought about that game in a while.
Oh man,
was that actually good?
I don't know. I never played that.
NBA Jam, Super Nintendo, Super Punch Out. Those would be good. Any of those like sports or like you know co-op or competitive games would be
NBA
really fun.
Jam is pretty great. Not gonna lie,
yeah.
NBA Jam is pretty awesome.
NBA Jam on. I would play a lot of that. I would actually probably.
Mario Kart was a game I played a lot of.
I might not buy the NES Classic, but. Uh-huh. If there was an SNES and it had some of those games, I think I would get that.
I'm going to buy it for one reason and one reason alone. So my friend Phil and I have kind of like competitions with all sorts of games. Like he beats me every single time in NBA 2K16 and I beat him in Smash Brothers and stuff like that. So we're going to go through, we're also both huge gambling addicts, so we're gonna go through all 30 games and put money on it and then see who can beat each other or like beat each other's time and more of the 30, so it'll be like best out of 30 basically. So whoever has 15 or more, and we're gonna put money on that, and whoever wins will get
the
money.
That sounds like a good way to do it.
But also, I'll probably review it for Kotaku. It'll be a fun thing to look at.
It'll be fun to write about. And it looks cool as hell. The thing I didn't realize, I saw photos of it from Comic-Con, is that it's freaking tiny.
I
didn't realize it was that tiny. I think that Like, it was just someone put it next to an NES. I think it was also partly that the original NES is way bigger than I remember it being. I think it's kind of gigantic. But seeing it next, it is just, it looks like a keychain or something, like next to an original NES.
Yeah, it looks like it's kind of like the size of like an Ouya.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
that anyone knows what an Ouya looks like. Right,
what's an Ouya? That'll be one. That will be one that in like 5 years you talk about the Ouya and there will just be a whole generation of people who are like, what? You're like, oh, the Ouya. Like, it's like the Lynx of that era.
Yeah, of course. Consoles. I mean, there are plenty of people today who don't remember, like, the TurboGrafx
exactly.
or, like, the Neo Geo or, like, any of those things. Okay, you want to do the next question?
You know we're going to get an angry email now where people are like, the TurboGrafx-16 was far superior to the Ouya and should not be compared to it in any way.
Of course.
The Atari Lynx was a fantastic handheld, underrated in its time. Okay, I'm doing the next one. Okay, this is from Andy. Andy writes, E3 has been great and showcased a lot of great-looking VR titles. However...
This is during E3.
Oh, this was an That explains that. Okay, so yeah. E3 has been great and showcased a lot of great-looking VR titles. However, they all seem to be first-person shootery. Do you foresee any future VR titles that are not first-person shooters? What might those look like? Yeah, I mean, I think there are plenty of VR games already that
yeah,
are
yeah, I disagree
shooters.
With that premise.
Right. So I guess some of the coolest VR games are not first-person shooters. We on our hilariously short list of the best VR games, I think, are any of them first-person shooters? Like, I really haven't played, actually, that many finished VR games that are first-person shooters. I think a lot of them are third-person, like a lot of the Oculus Rift games, like Edge of Nowhere and Lucky's Tale, and then there's a lot of space sim games that are really good. House of the Dying Sun is really cool in VR, and Elite Dangerous, and those are space games, so they're not really first-person shooters. And
yeah, I think third-person works better just because of the whole motion sickness thing.
Yeah, getting you outside of the thing definitely works. I mean, or like there are also games that are first-person, but they're just not shooters. Like there's a really, the Pinball Ultimate, I think it's FX Pinball, I always get the words mixed up. It's the pinball game that's on Oculus Rift, is very cool because you play with a controller and you're standing over the pinball table. And it's just a pinball table, and you just look down and you play pinball with, like, the triggers on the controller or, like, the two buttons. And it's rad. It's like playing pinball. Or the pool game. What's it called? Ultimate Pool something? It's on Vive. It's sweet. Like, it's, like, incredible, actually. It's one of the most impressive demonstrations of VR because you're playing pool. Like, it's, like, it feels like you're playing pool because you're in room scale, so you're walking around the table and, like, hitting the balls, and the physics are all accurately modeled. That was
why would you want to do that instead of just playing pool?
Well, because you can do it in your living room and you don't have to have a pool table.
I guess, but you would want to play. Can you play against other people?
Yeah. And you know, these games have, but you can't play against other people in the same room. Actually, maybe you can. I wonder if you can. I should know this.
So you play it with people online.
Or I wonder if you could play, if you could play it with other people though, and like just give them the headset and then it's just like,
or what if you both have headsets on?
Well, you can't run two Vives on one PC, so that would be a bridge too far for the technology right now. But, you know, it's not exactly pool, but it's very cool. It's like a very cool VR game. And, yeah, I mean, I guess then, like, Raw Data is the new one that I still need to do a video on that's extremely cool, and that is a first-person shooter. And that's kind of the most impressive first-person shooter I've played in VR, but that's kind of the only one, so... Yeah, I would
say... It's crazy. By the way, while we're on VR, it's crazy that PlayStation VR comes out in just, like, 2 months. Because that's the one that I think will really make a difference. Like, the success of that will have a lot of impact on how viable VR is in the near future. Like if people pick it up and are like, holy shit, this is great, I think it'll be a lot more like, oh, this is actually a short-term thing. As opposed to if you pick it up and it's kind of janky and rough and the frame rates aren't great, then it's more like, okay, this tech is really not where it needs to be yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the games are going to work fine, I would imagine, just because I've played a lot of them, and I guess I don't know for sure they were all running on PS4s, but...
Right, like, that's the question.
Right, I don't think, though, that it's going to be an issue, because they're all really stylized, and they're not doing anything as ambitious as some of the stuff that's happening on PC.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, yeah, you're right. It'll be a question. I guess I'm still skeptical just about PSVR in general, but we'll see.
Okay.
All right,
okay,
next one.
Next question. Brian asks, "Hi, Jason and Kirk. Saw the request for questions on Twitter. Here's mine. If the rumors are true that Nintendo's NX is actually going to be a less powerful handheld, isn't Nintendo going to fall even further behind Microsoft and Sony and their soon-to-be-released more powerful consoles? What is Nintendo thinking?" So let me give some context for that. So earlier this week, Eurogamer reported, they had a big blowout report on the NX. They say that their sources tell them that the NX is basically a handheld console that plugs into a docking station on your TV. So it's essentially a portable that can also be blown up and played on the TV. It's like a reverse Wii U. And it has a detachable controller, and it runs using one of those Tegra chips, which you can find, I think, in the NVIDIA Shield and like other NVIDIA stuff, which is the equivalent. I mean, they're speculating that it'll be a Tegra 2, which hasn't been announced yet.
Well, and that's really... Also, they qualify that speculation pretty hard. They were like, this is, it was like based on some very like, you know, there's apparently a loud fan on the NX dev kit. So they were thinking maybe because this isn't cooled normally, it's just like a temporary processor and it would line up maybe. It was very loose though. So it's, they still say it's likely it'll be the Tegra.
I mean, it's safe to say it's going to be a chip that's made just for the NX and not like something that is found in the other Android powered hardware. But the point is that this, it's not going to be as powerful as Neo and Scorpio for sure. Might be, I mean, I think a safe guess is that it's as powerful as an Xbox One or like a PS4 today, like a, somewhere between that or in that range, which means, so first of all, assuming this rumor is true, and I think it is, I haven't been able to independently confirm this, none of us have, but we've definitely heard similar rumblings, and I saw a couple of things that I can't really get into that were kind of like good confirmation of this. So yeah, so I think it's true. I actually am really psyched about this because I think Nintendo's best stuff is their handheld production. And I think you agree with me. Like, the 3DS is such a great system. Their handheld gaming has always been incredible.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I agree just because I don't like using the Wii U, and I didn't really have a Wii for any prolonged period of time and didn't own Nintendo consoles before that. So the Wii U is my first console. And, you know, that's not really fair because it's kind of a bummer console, but I don't even like using it. So where I love the 3DS, and I love so many 3DS games that, I agree. I think it'd be fine if Nintendo's one console was like a pretty powerful handheld.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Right. So as far as the question of competition, I think the important thing here is that they're not competing with Sony and Microsoft. If they're making a handheld, they're competing even more so with Apple and Google and phones and tablets. And so the big question is, will people be willing to add this to their repertoire of iPads and iPhones and things they carry around with them? So the 3DS sold pretty well, but it didn't have quite the same momentum as the DS before it, which is definitely impacted by mobile gaming and handheld and iPad gaming and stuff like that. So the question is, can they still carve out a big force in the marketplace? And I think they can for this reason. Now, assuming this is all true and there's no other component to this that we're not thinking of, like maybe there's another SKU with like a console device, but let's assume that's not true and that's not the case and that the NX is just a portable system. Now, instead of like they have for decades having two different like branches, one making 3DS games and one making Wii U games, or one making Game Boy games and one making Super Nintendo games, now they have all of their software power focused on one console, which is unprecedented for Nintendo, and it'll basically mean double the games. It'll mean they're gonna have a much bigger software output than they ever did on those other consoles. And if you combine that with like their legacy stuff, like if they finally get Virtual Console, their shit together on that, this could be a really awesome thing. Just like for some context for people, the mini NES. Do you remember the traffic on that post? I think people were so psyched about that. It was just our announcement post had like some 800,000 page views, something like that. And for context, the announcement of the new Zelda had like 200,000 page views. So mm-hmm. people were really, really hyped about the mini NES. So they have that to fall back on and that kind of retro stuff. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think it can kind of carve out a niche in the marketplace that doesn't need to compete with Sony and Microsoft?
Yeah, I mean, sure. It's possible. Like, I think what you're saying is kind of a best case scenario. The idea that Nintendo can take all of their, you know, development might and focus it on one console.
Wishful thinking. Yeah.
And it's like, and now we're going to get twice as many great games. Like, that would be cool. At the same time, like, I don't know, like, if this thing is more powerful than a Wii U, that also means that the games are going to take more work, most likely. You know, it's going to be the same issue of third-party development for the system that they ran into with the Wii U, whereby upgrading to, like, HD graphics and having a more powerful thing meant you need bigger teams, meaning it's a bigger risk for a third-party developer to come, or an outside developer to come make a game, which means that they're going to... people are going to be less likely to take those risks. Like, you know, suddenly like Ubisoft is like, yeah, we're not making games for Wii U anymore because it's not worth the risk. So that could happen again. You know, the sense I always got was that the DS was really easy to develop for because it just wasn't very powerful and like small teams could make cool DS games. Even though to make a DS game, you had to make a game that was basically most of the time like going to only run on DS because you made it for two screens and like did all this mm-hmm. extra shit. So, you know, that could happen again. Like, they could still wind up being like, we have a bunch of cool Nintendo games and kind of nothing else, and if you're not really into Nintendo games, you know, people are still going to play Pokemon Go on their phones and they're still going to play other games on their phones, but they're not really going to break through to people who do that. So I don't know, but I mean, personally, I love the idea. I love the idea mm-hmm. of like a portable thing with a really nice screen that can play the new Zelda game on the go, and then I can plug it into my TV and it plays it in 1080p. Like, hell yeah. I love that idea. It would make me play so many more of these games. I wish I could do that with my Wii U.
Portable gaming is just so much better. Yeah.
Like if I could take my Wii U controller with me and play all those games on the go, I would fucking play everything like all the time. So I love that. Like, I think that's great. And that alone might be enough.
Yeah. So I don't even know if they really need third party. I mean, I feel like they might have enough of a first party base. Saw with Pokemon Go just how strong their franchises are.
Well, and if
are.
They wind up even in a situation like the 3DS where there's just a lot of really good games that are mostly all first party, that's fine with me. And also like I view it in one way in terms of like Nintendo's prospects, but also I just as a gamer, like I love the idea of that console. I think it just sounds great and I'm totally fine with them. Like, you know, going back to the initial question, like I don't give a shit if Nintendo's hardware isn't as powerful as like the PlayStation Neo or even the PS4, like that's fine. Like I've never gotten the sense that Nintendo's games require that kind of overhead to be great. So sure, that's fine with me. If it makes it easier for them to do what they do and make a profit and turn out good games, that's what matters.
Yeah. The on the go thing is really cool. Yeah, I don't know. I'm excited. I think it's a good fresh start for them after the failure of the Wii U. Mm-hmm. They can kind of cut out that brand and call it something totally new. I saw someone suggest that they should call it Nintendo Go, which I think is a cool idea.
Oh, that is kind of cool.
It's cool, right, when you buy a Nintendo Go?
Yeah.
But just the idea they can start new. They can
they're gonna
have
call
this
it,
totally...
You know they're going to call it like the we go or something.
It's going to be dumb. But terrible. They have an opportunity to like start fresh with marketing and like have this like a smart marketing message that doesn't muddle things the way they did with the Wii U, where nobody knew if it was like actually a Wii or an accessory to the Wii.
Yeah.
Even today, people still don't know it exists. They think, oh, Wii U, like that Wii accessory.
I still am skeptical. I still think about all of the like minor fuck ups with the Wii U, and it makes me be like, I know it'd be great if they totally get it right, but like things like with the controller would just die and you'd have to charge it and you'd be sitting there with it plugged in, like that kind of stuff. I'm like, I really hope that it doesn't have any of those like annoyances or like first generation problems that they fix in a later one that you have to buy again like a year later.
Yep.
Here's hoping. I hope it's cool. I really liked what I heard and what I saw in that Eurogamer report. I think that is exciting.
Yes, I hope it's true. Okay, you want to do the next question from James?
Yes, we're on to James. Okay. This is from James. He says, now that legacy consoles are dropped from Destiny, how will this affect Destiny? More updates, more content, now that they don't have four systems to support? What do you think? What do you think of that, Mr.
Well, it
Destiny?
Won't affect Destiny now. It's more setting up for Destiny 2, which I think will be a totally new game that feels a lot more different in a lot of ways. I don't think that, like, as far as, I mean, maybe development-wise, so what happened, and I don't know how many people actually know this, what happened was they had a live team working on events and stuff after the Taken King, which is why we got the Spyro Racing League and, like, what was the other stuff? The October, like, Festival of the Lost thing and that sort of stuff, and also all those, like, timed quests for, like, the Sleeper Simulant and stuff like that. And then in January, when Destiny 2 was delayed, as we reported, to 2017, they also decided to build an expansion for this year, and they had the live team become sort of like the DLC team. So they were doing an April update, which is kind of slim stuff and mostly like system stuff, like upping the light level and balancing loot drops and fixing infuse and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But they were mostly working on this fall stuff, which is why there hasn't been any new content, and like Spiral Racing League hasn't come back, and we haven't had any other quests or events or anything like that since last year, basically. So the question is, what are they going to do after this fall stuff? Are they going to do another DLC next year before Destiny 2 comes out, or are they going to work on live stuff, more updates? And I don't know the answer to that. And I also don't know if it's like easier. I assume it's easier for them to work on the game without having to worry about cross-gen, and they don't have to worry about like memory budgets for the last-gen consoles, which are, from what I hear from developers, that's the killer, is that you just have this very limited amount of memory, where on PS4 and Xbox One, you have a lot more. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't think it'll be. I think it'll be a very minimal effect until next year. I think that we'll really start to see the effects of them dropping legacy consoles in Destiny 2 when that comes out.
Yeah, I get the feeling that, you know, the effect right now is probably more of an effect on Bungie than it is on any of us. Like, it's something that they can probably feel immediately, only because whatever number of people they had allocated to making sure shit worked on Xbox 360 can now do something else, because that's just no longer a thing they need to do. And then, yeah, we'll probably start to see little things like stuff like inventory size, or I don't know, like that kind of thing maybe would increase, or some little thing like that. We're like, okay, we can finally do this for next gen. We can start having it, you know, adding a few features. But yeah, I think it won't be until Destiny 2 that it'll...
Yeah, because I don't know exactly. And they might have said this. I'm not 100% sure. I know that, so legacy console players won't get the new expansion. But I think if they make any, like, mechanical changes, Destiny players on 360 and PS3 might get that. I'm not 100% sure.
Oh, it's really?
Like, oh, no. Wait, actually, no. Because there was an update this week that was the last final update for PS3 and 360 players. So yeah, so everything from now on will just be for PS4 and Xbox One. Well, then the other wrinkle is that Neo and Scorpio are coming, and that they'll have to worry about those too. So it might turn into the same exact problem, just on the opposite end, which would be a disaster for them and other devs. But
makes
we'll
me
see.
These kinds of things make me really glad I don't make video games. It's kind of a good segue to the next question from Levy.
From Levy.
Levy.
He says how to pronounce it.
Oh, he says how? Oh, Levy.
Yeah, Levy.
Okay, you got this one.
He says, Hello, Jason and Kirk. I can't stop thinking about the Neo and Scorpio. With Scorpio's official revealed specs, should Sony go back to the drawing board and improve the specs of Neo? Also, since these new consoles are coming out, shouldn't developers start making games with quality settings, like low to ultra? Wouldn't this help, similar to on PC? Wouldn't this help consoles moving forward and also give the PS4 and Xbox a longer life if they can run games 4 years from now on at least low settings? Current-gen consoles are more PCS than ever before. Hope I got my point across. Thanks for the awesome podcast. Well, you are welcome, Levy. He also says, P.S., please do the stream PC building with Kirk. That would be awesome. Yeah, we should do that day. Next time you're in New York, maybe. Yeah. Maybe next year. I actually think that is what they're going to do. Well, mm-hmm. So to answer the second question of the quality settings load through Ultra, I mean, I think that is both companies, Sony and Microsoft, are going for that, where they want their games to be playable across all of their different systems. Like, I don't think they're going to be – I think all the stuff that is leaked out about Neo has said that there won't be any games that are Neo exclusive. It'll all just be forwards and backwards compatible.
Yeah, I think that's how it's going to work. It's interesting because I think will be a bigger challenge for developers, just because you have to optimize a couple of different versions of the game to like console standards, even though that's less of a thing now than it used to be. Like, we still see console games with fluctuating frame rates that aren't optimized well. But it'll be hard to kind of have that same console standard of, okay, the high version of this game runs this well on the Neo, and the low uh-huh. version runs this well on the existing, you know, PS4. I wonder if it'll really be like the same as PC, like if it'll really be high, medium, low, or if really there'll just be Scorpio settings and Xbox One settings, you know, like if you yeah. just, and you don't really get to pick, like you just, whichever version you install,
that
just
makes
plays
more sense.
That. Like, it seems like otherwise it's going to get a little weird. Like, people will be like, well, I'd prefer to play the Xbox One settings, but on the Scorpio, because it gets better performance, like. That just seems like that's adding a lot of uncertainty for people, when one of the appeals of console is that you don't have that kind of uncertainty.
Yeah, I agree. That seems like it would be a mess. But who knows? I mean, with Microsoft, anything can happen. Like, I always expect Microsoft to just be changing their plans like every month. With Sony, well, so to address the first question Levy had, which is should Sony improve the specs of the Neo, because the rumor right now, well, so Microsoft has said 6 teraflops is what they're going for, as we discussed.
We're
you love
teraflop
teraflops.
Battle here.
Which yes. is just a measure of power. Basically, in short, the rumored specs for Neo are that it's going to be less powerful than Scorpio. And on one hand, does that really matter? Because if multi-platform devs are going to be making games for both systems, and there probably won't be significant differences. On the other hand, the narrative of this console generation has always been, oh, games run better on PS4 at 1080p, like 60 frames per second, while on Xbox One, which is slightly less powerful than PS4, they might run at like 900p and like 30 frames per second, something like that. So it would be really interesting if Microsoft kind of sees that story back. And so the question is, should Sony like start rethinking things now? I don't know. It might be too late at this point if they're planning on launching it this year alongside PSVR.
Yeah, I mean, it'll just depend on what they announce, right? Like, I kind of remember, I can't exactly remember the numbers, but there was a question of the PS4's video RAM and how the RAM would work. And I remember there was this open question and people thinking, well, how powerful is it going to be? And then they announced it and it was like, oh, shit. Yeah. Like, people weren't really quite expecting that. So it could well be they announce it and it's, you know, more powerful.
I think RAM is an easier thing to upgrade than a GPU.
Right. Well, this was video RAM, which is the thing within the GPU. So, like,
no, I thought it was DRAM. Is what we were. No, is that a different
on the PS4? Yeah. The PS4 has like some kind of unified RAM, and this is getting beyond my like expertise. But the PS4's RAM is like a different, slightly different type of RAM, I believe, than like just runs on your PC's
Got
GPU.
It.
Could be totally wrong.
No, you're
Don't
right.
Email
no,
me.
You're right. I remember reading about that. I'm also not a technical expert on these things, but I do remember reading some interesting stuff about the way that it's handled.
Yeah. So it was more like big picture. There was that question with the
right.
PS4, where like when they announced it, it was like, oh, it's slightly different than we thought it would be. That could still happen with the Neo. I think you're probably right that it's too late to dramatically change, especially because they likely have developers like already with like the specs, knowing what they're working with, at least to
Yeah, well, so the rumor in that documentation, which might be out of date, was that they have to start, like, any game released after X date, which I think was September something or another, has to have a patch that will, like, make it support Neo, some post-launch patch that supports Neo and makes it run better on Neo or whatever. And then I think the rumor was Neo in October. To coincide with PlayStation VR, which would make sense. They might have delayed it. Who knows? I assume
that seems really soon for a new thing that.
Yeah, well, think about it. I mean, it's not like Microsoft's approach was unusual, announcing Scorpio so far in advance. And I think they only did that because of Neo, because all the Neo rumors have been circulating, and they wanted to kind of preempt Sony. But what the right approach with the hardware? I mean, the approach that these companies usually take is to announce it as close as possible to the actual release, so they don't waste any sales with people having to wait for new hardware.
Right.
That and that's what Microsoft did with the Xbox Slim. So I can see like that Sony doing some big blowout event in September and then releasing it in October. Or like if they announce it next year, or if they want to sell it next year, then just announcing it next year. So I think it'll be very soon between when they announce it and when they actually sell it.
To the graphics thing, I think it's interesting. Like the question of like, what if the narrative flips and suddenly Scorpio has more graphical power than the PS4? It would be interesting, and it'd be interesting to see how it plays out, partly because it's not exactly like a new console. So we've already kind of established like that narrative, I think, did help the PS4 outsell the Xbox One for a long time. And at this point, a lot more people have PS4s than Xbox Ones, or at least a fair number. And those people are all just going to update to the Neo because they already own all these games that are going to play. If they're going to update, they're going to get that console because, like, you'll be able to play all their PS4 games on it. And so, you know, Sony almost gets to ride the momentum from having had the early lead, even if Microsoft corrects in the back half and suddenly now has the more powerful console.
Yeah, that's true.
It seems like it won't be as impactful. Like when the PS4 and Xbox One came out, remember how many like times we had talked about that and like wrote about that and people got up in arms about that difference, the kind of arms race thing. And I'm sure that'll be a thing with these new ones as well, but it doesn't quite feel the same as like when there were new consoles and there were a whole new generation. This is like a slightly different.
Yeah, that's a good point. But also, I mean, I guess it depends what type of gamer you are. But like, imagine the next Elder Scrolls game or something like that. Like those games that feel like they were developed for PC. Although I guess if you really care, you would just get a freaking PC.
Yeah, I mean that's truer than ever.
But yeah, I don't know. It'll be so interesting because we don't really know what Scorpio is or what the advantages really are. Like if powerful Xbox, then like what's the point? Like I feel like, I don't know. And it also depends how big 4K becomes over the next couple of years. Will that make a difference to people?
I don't know. All of this, I guess, is so speculative and
really
kind of so
is.
Far out.
Yeah,
it's really, like, even though we speculate some on this show, this feels pretty far out in terms of, like, what it's actually going to be like.
And actually, I think if Neo, let's say hypothetically Neo comes out this October, right? And then Scorpio isn't until next holiday. I think Neo would have a huge advantage, even if Scorpio is more powerful than
Definitely.
Neo. I don't know, if you have a Neo for this long and like the Neo has a year or two of you getting games and then being like really great running and great performing and great looking on the Neo, why would anyone care about the Scorpio?
Well, and there's the question of games. I mean, I think I was just, you know, editing our Xbox One and PS4 bests lists, and I really, you know, I think the PS4 still has the stronger library. Xbox One has gotten better. Yeah. They definitely have some cool stuff. They have Inside now, which is like pretty cool, even though it's on PC. Like they have some good games.
Well, all their games are
on
PC. That's the other thing.
Well, yeah. Now, right now, yeah, that's
even
true.
Halo. Halo Six is going to be on PC.
But I mean more. They have games that aren't on PS4.
Yes.
Like, and so like looking at their list, it no longer feels like okay. I'm looking at basically the same games as the PS4 list. Only the PS4 list has Bloodborne and Uncharted and The Last of Us, and like you know, like Gravity Rush is coming out this year, and they're getting whatever other exclusives like that. That won't change, and so people, I think, are gonna, you know, whenever the Neo comes out, and for the next year, like there's still gonna be that sense of like, well, I have this huge, really good game library, where the Xbox One is still, it's better, but it's not, like, to me anyway. When I look at the two, I'm like, yeah, there's still better games there. So that's going to convince people as much as like, you know, teraflops.
Well, we will have a lot of time to keep talking about this because it will be an ongoing conversation for the next year.
I'm almost exhausted thinking about it. Maybe this can be the only time we ever
talk about
it.
Yeah, let's just never talk about it again.
We'll just refer back to this half-assed, like, half-informed conversation that we had in the middle of 2016. We'll be like, we already covered this.
All right. You want to do the next question?
Yeah.
We have a lot more to go. We might not get through all of them, but we'll
do
our best.
Well, we can always do more next week. Doc Darius, when did you first hear and start using the term JRPG? No one ever said that growing up. Never appeared in Nintendo Power, EGM, IGN, Thegia. What is that? What is THEGIA? Is that a magazine?
Mm-hmm. No, the GIA. Oh. That's the site.
Oh, the GIA. Oh, I thought it was one word. There's no space there. Okay. It was always console or computer RPG if you had to distinguish. So just curious why you think everyone decided to pick it up. Mm-hmm. Personally, I don't think it's a distinction that's needed because there are so many exceptions in terms of aesthetics, structure, and battle systems that it's more informative to just say action, turn-based, strategy, gritty, lighthearted, open, linear, or whatever. But I'm curious what you guys think in light of your last episode. It's just weird to me how everyone made the switch. What do you think, Mr. JRPG expert?
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like it's a relatively recent thing because Western developers stopped making RPGs just for computers and started making RPGs for consoles. So you couldn't say console RPG versus computer RPG and expect people to know the difference anymore. I don't know. I've always found genre conversations to be pretty boring. And like, I don't really care if it's a JRPG. Like, I don't really care about what we call things. I just care about kind of dissecting games and looking at them in interesting ways. So I don't know. I don't really care that much about the term JRPG. I just use it because it's convenient and people know what you're talking about when you say JRPG.
Yeah, I agree about the genre thing only because you can debate forever whether something is a shooter or whether it's not a shooter, whether it's an adventure game or whether it's a JRPG and what that means. Sometimes those conversations can be like fun or illuminating in some way, but generally they're not, and they wind up sort of you wind up talking more about that than actually talking about the game in question, which is very easy to do. I mean, it's a version of the it's not a game question.
Right.
Like, is it a game? Isn't it a game? Who gives a shit? Like, let's just talk about is it good? Like, is it cool? Did it make me, like, feel something? Which is the more interesting question anyway. I agree. I use it because when I say it's a JRPG, people kind of know what I mean, like, in a broad term and then in a broad sense. And then you always wind up just sort of then you specify. Like, I don't think anyone ever just says this is a JRPG. You know, like, the suggestion it's saying is it turn-based, is it action, is it strategy? Like, I think those distinctions always come along with calling it a JRPG. Like, you don't ever just have one way to describe a game and then you have to move on. You'll always say, oh, it's a JRPG. It's like an action JRPG. It's like a really funny JRPG that takes place in high school and, like, has a cool turn-based battle system. Like, you always explain
the talking
game,
bear.
So, yeah, has the talking bear.
Speaking of JRPGs, this next question is pretty good. Kavan,
okay.
Kavan, whatever. Sorry, I'm mispronouncing that. He says, I was thinking about Suikoden 2 today because I am a good human being, and I was thinking about how many of my friends still have not played it.
Did you just get something in your throat
which
there,
leads me to my next question. What do you think is the best way to encourage someone to try a game? Personally, I try to relate it to something else they like my friend who loves Pokemon. I tell him that Suikoden 2 is like Pokemon, except you are gathering / capturing people. That's a good comparison. Yeah, I think that trying to relate it to someone else is definitely a good way of doing it. I don't know, what's the best way to encourage someone to try a game, Kirk?
I think about this a lot, both about games and about other media as well, because I consume a lot of media and other people in my life don't always, like, just friends who aren't professional games critics. And there are times where I want to say, yeah, you should really watch Jessica Jones on Netflix.
Yeah.
It's super good. And then you want to kind of convince someone, but it's hard when, and I think you run into this with people, you've run into this with me, it's hard when you want to recommend so many things to somebody.
Yeah, there's so many
that you overwhelm
things.
Them.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think with you and me, it has lessened the impact of each individual recommendation because every time we talk about one of the games you want me to play, you'll understandably say you should play this. Like, we were just talking about Final Fantasy Tactics today, and you're like, man, you really need to play that game. And then every time Secret of the Two comes up, you're like, man, you really need to play that game. I mean, I've played some of it. I played about the same percentage as Suikoden 2, but I haven't, like, finished. You know, each of these JRPGs I've kind of started and been like, that was pretty good, and then gotten distracted. So then it gets hard when I start to feel like I'm like, well, I know these are all good. It's just that I have three or four giant, you know, JRPGs.
But you're in a different position than I don't know, because I found that I feel like I get a lot of messages from readers being like, hey, I just played Trails in the Sky, or like, I just played Suikoden 2 because of your recommendation. Thank you so much for recommending that. So I don't know. I think you and I both have totally different perspectives because we play so many games for our jobs.
I think so, but I think that's also very different. Like, a reader taking your recommendation and playing it is different than, like, making a recommendation to the people in your life. Like, I have a list of running TV shows with a friend of mine, uh-huh. and I'm always kind of almost like keeping a document with it, like, tracks all of the different shows. And there comes a point where it's like, okay, we'll add it to the document. And it's this overwhelming list of just like four or five TV shows that have like two or three seasons each. And they're all amazing. But it's different when it's like a person that I have a relationship with who I'm recommending to. And I think the easiest way really is to not overwhelm people and to really recommend the one thing and to just recommend it. And then you can't just keep recommending it, even though that does work with You on Me. It's a little different because like we're doing game stuff and like it's our jobs, but I find it's effective a lot of times to just be like, look, this is super good, you should check it out. The person will almost always go and look at it at least and see if they what they think of it, and it's gonna take them deciding like, okay, this looks like enough of my jam that I'm gonna watch it.
But games are a little different because games are such a bigger commitment even than shows.
Well, I guess, but you can look at like a trailer or like the beginning of a Let's Play or something.
Yeah, that's
true. Like, okay, yeah, this looks like something I'd be into. Like when someone recommends whatever.
But I think I would say it's harder to get someone to play a game than it is to get someone to watch a show if you're talking to them. Because playing a game, it's so easy to binge watch a show and you don't really have to think while you're doing it. Playing a game requires
participation. Yeah, and you don't have to pay for the show. Like, you don't have to, like, the game you have to buy. Like, the show, maybe it's just like a Netflix show and you already have Netflix. Yeah. Like, so yeah, it is harder. I do think that, like, saying, hey, it's a lot like, you know, if you like this, you'll like this. I think that is generally good.
Yeah.
It's a good way to go. But I'd say don't overwhelm people is the best.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. Advice. Yeah, it's something that I will have to consider next time I'm telling you to play video games. Really, I mean, Suikoden 2 is just like, that should be your number one priority because that's the greatest game mm-hmm. of all time. So it's mm-hmm. like, you're just like, I know I've given you a lot of recommendations, but just think of Suikoden 2 as like the top of that list because, as mm-hmm. I just said, it's the greatest video game of all time. Mm-hmm. Is that clear mm-hmm. enough?
Yeah, you also compared it to Game of Thrones, I think.
It's like, Game of Thrones like really meets good Pokemon. Politics. Right. That whole meets thing. Good. That's such a funny thing. I went to film school, and that was always the funny thing, is like in pitches and films and
stuff. Oh, yeah, every elevator pitch ever is such and such meets. Yeah. Yep. It's funny because I don't really like Pokemon, so that's not like the most compelling pitch. But I do really like Game of Thrones, so it's like 50-50 on that pitch.
Yeah, I don't like Pokemon either, but the Pokemon part isn't really... I mean, it's like the good part of Pokemon, which is like the discovering new people or like new creatures.
Right. No, I get
as opposed to the shitty parts of Pokemon, which are just about everything. one day we'll have to do an episode where we just trash Pokemon.
I would need to sit down and actually like play 3 or 4 hours of X and Y.
Maybe when the new one comes out, Sun and Moon.
I know. Do we really need to play the new one? Can't you just play any of them and they're all
the same? They're all exactly the same. They're all, like, insipid. Man, the thing that really bothers me about Pokemon is that the dialogue is just, like, you talk to NPCs and they just have the dumbest shit to say.
Didn't you say, I remember you wrote this article, I'm sure, that got you a lot of happy comments about how you don't like Pokemon.
Yeah.
And what wasn't, if I recall correctly, your takeaway was, and this is accurate, that in the world of Pokemon, all anyone talks about is Pokemon.
Yeah.
And so it starts to feel like kind of psychotic after a while. Because you're like, why is everyone here just, their whole life is just Pokemon? Like, they just never talk about anything
else. Yeah, they don't have actual personalities. They just talk about training Pokemon and like where to find Pokemon.
I thought that was a funny observation that definitely is true. And you made me laugh.
So you want to do the next question?
Yeah.
I think we have time for like two more, maybe.
Okay, that'll work. We'll save the rest for next time. Okay. Here is the next one from Rob. Hey guys, I'm a little dismayed that there hasn't been more attention on the Warner Brothers Shadow of Mordor business. And I guess we can recap it after this for people who don't know. I know this was kind of a big news a few weeks back, but it seems like there are a lot of unanswered questions about the situation. For example, do we know which YouTubers besides PewDiePie were involved in this campaign? Do we know if those YouTubers had any disclosures or added adequate disclosures after the fact? Do we know what else they were paid for? Settlement docs mentioned some YouTubers getting paid for social media promotion. Mm-hmm. Do we know if the Shadow of Mordor campaign was the only one Warner Bros. Contracted to Plaid Social Labs? I feel like the story isn't getting the kind of coverage it deserves, and that someone needs to be demanding answers from WB and others involved.
Well, good luck on that, demanding answers from WB.
Well, I, for one, wish that there was a group, some sort of organized, like, grassroots group who was concerned with, like,
ethics,
you know, ethics and video games and all of this kind of stuff. Because they could really go after Warner Bros. And maybe get some answers on that. So that could be a good first step, maybe, is if we organize some sort of a campaign.
Well, it depends. Does Shadow of Mordor have any feminism in it?
I don't really think so.
Oh,
no.
Then nope, it's a no-go.
I bet I could find some, though. There's like a lady character you can get her skin and she plays.
No. If there are women in it, then that's a problem.
Then, oh my God, we're on this. What do you think about this? You've covered this more closely than I did. I was actually on vacation when it broke, though I read all about
it. Well, it actually broke in 2014.
Right, when it came back up, I should say.
Yeah, it came back up. So the story, for anyone who isn't familiar with this, I'll give a quick summary. So the story is basically in 2014, when Shadow of Mordor was coming out, Warner Brothers gave out all these conditions. Their marketing team worked with YouTubers and they said, hey, you can have an early copy of the game. If you make videos about it, you agree to talk positively about it and we'll give you money, but you can't talk about like the bugs or glitches or anything like that. And I think that the specific detail was that Warner Brothers didn't require them to disclose, or like they told them to disclose that they had been paid, but they could do it like buried under the fold, so you had to click more info in the YouTube description, and they didn't have to put them in their videos. And then so what happened is some YouTubers disclosed it and some didn't, and some added disclosures afterwards, and some added disclosures like below the fold in their more info thing. That's what PewDiePie did. He had a disclosure saying paid by Warner Brothers, but it was you had to click more info in the description to see it. Mm-hmm. And then so right afterwards, the FTC started going after them, because the FTC is all about like proper disclosures and their specific regulations when it comes to that. And I'm not sure how much power the FTC has. I think they can fine people, companies, but I'm not 100% sure how much legislative power they actually have there. All that said, what happened was Warner Brothers settled with the FTC, so there were no fines, and Warner Brothers agreed. And this was the news a couple weeks ago. Which was Warner Brothers agreed to require more disclosures on future, like the next time they do plans like this, they will be more clear about it and force the YouTubers they're working with to be more clear about it. So first of all, if you watch YouTube videos, you should know that there are all sorts of things like this going on pretty much all the time. A lot of companies do this sort of thing. Some YouTubers are good about disclosing it. Others are not. Some companies are sketchy about it and will ask those YouTubers to like say specific things. Others will just say, we just want coverage of this game. Others, like Warner Brothers in this case, will say, you can't talk about the bugs and glitches. And it's kind of a weird situation because there are a lot of questions. One of them is, is this unethical or is it not? Because they're just showing gameplay and they're not like doing quote unquote reviews, and they're not trying to be objective and offer like an unbiased perspective on things. The other question is, do YouTube viewers even care about this? Like, a lot of the people watching these YouTube videos are kind of young. The demographic tends to skew younger, like below 18 in some cases. Do they really care about the ethics and disclosure? And do they really care about whether their YouTubers are being paid by companies, or do they just want to see cool games? I don't know. There are no easy answers to these questions. I've always felt like it's kind of like standards are so low. It's such a wild west of disclosure and conflicts of interest and stuff like that, that it never really bothered me. But I also don't watch any of these YouTubers, so my perspective is a little bit different. I don't know. Does it bother you?
It bugs me a little, or at least bugs is the wrong word. I think that it's interesting that so much of the narrative around YouTube and YouTubers is like, we're independent and we provide the, like, a real voice that of, you know, like a recommendation for a game that you can trust because you know me, you come to my channel every day, you watch me play games and yeah. you get me, like, I'm on your side. And then on the flip side of that is like the mainstream press, and the mainstream gaming press is all corrupt and they're all like bought and paid for by advertising, where the truth of the matter is kind of not that
it's
at all.
It's kind of the opposite.
There are plenty of, well, in some cases, there are, of course, plenty of YouTubers who are just for real and, like, do their thing, but then there are, like, ethically weird lines there. But, yeah, and, like, then the majority, or the vast majority, I would say, of mainstream games press, and this isn't just me protecting, like, the people, the clan I'm a member of, it's, like, that there are standards in place. When you work at a major publication, like, there are ethics standards, there are things that you have to abide by, like, you follow the rules and you don't, like, that kind of shit just doesn't happen.
Well,
and if it does, it's a big deal.
Yeah, the big difference is that, like, when a company like Warner Brothers wants to take out ads on Kotaku, they will go through our ad team. But on
right.
YouTube, when a company like Warner Brothers wants to, like, get ads on YouTube, they will go straight to the YouTuber and say, hey, we want to pay you to talk about this. So there's always been in journalism this wall between advertising and editorial, and that still exists on sites like ours. Like, we have sponsored posts on our sites that have nothing to do with the editorial staff and are written by totally different people. But when they go to YouTubers, they're going to the same people. So, like,
right,
so
right. That's the big difference.
The murkier questions aren't, like, don't involve the Shadow of Mordor thing. So, like, let's say I'm a YouTuber and Warner Brothers comes to me and pays me to do this Shadow of Mordor video, and, like, even up front right away I say, this is paid by Warner Brothers, full disclosure, yada yada, and then I do my thing. The ethical questions are a lot murkier and come to when I'm making other videos. Like, do I have to think in my head, hey, do I really want to piss off Warner Brothers, because then they won't want to give me any more of those advertising opportunities? And, like, the fact that people have to ask those questions is a problem. And that's when you start getting into really shitty ethical territory, because if, let's say, if I'm a YouTuber and I do that and I'm also a reviewer, I might subconsciously give higher, like, better, more positive things, or, like, brush some negative things under the rug when I'm reviewing the next Warner Brothers game because I have that previous relationship with them. And I think that sort of thing does happen to the web games press as well, but in different ways.
Yeah.
Like, if you work for a game site, and this certainly does not happen at Kotaku, a site that has been blacklisted by a couple of publishers, but if you work for, like, a website that has, like, exclusive coverage arrangements with game publishers, and like maybe you do exclusive previews with them or whatever, you want to get the big game announcements on your site because you want the scoops on your site, you might subconsciously think to yourself, hey, do I really want to piss them off by doing this and this thing, by reporting this other thing, or by, like, writing this other thing? And so it leads to a lot of, like, murky subconscious questions, and you can be influenced by that even in ways that aren't, like, apparent to you. It can be subtle things.
I think that that's all true. I do also think that sometimes it feels like it's easy to consider these sorts of questions in a, not in a vacuum exactly, but, like, separate from just how everything in life is kind of this way. Because really, like, you know, even for us, like, being blacklisted by a company, that's, like, a really dramatic example.
Uh-huh.
But just for anyone who's ever had a sort of, not a relationship is the wrong word, but who's played a lot of games from a studio, you start to just have a picture of them in your mind.
Sure.
And you think fondly on that last game that you really liked, or, like, that time that you were depressed and, like, the one game really got you through it. Like, we're just talking about biases, right? And everybody has countless large and small biases.
Yes.
And really, like, when it comes down to it, no matter, all of this stuff notwithstanding, what matters is if you feel like you know the person whose opinion you're trusting in this given case, and you trust them, then you trust them. And that, really, when it comes down to it, that matters more. Like,
yeah.
I sometimes think about this stuff from the viewpoint of a viewer instead of the viewpoint of the YouTuber, say, in this case. Like, the thing you said about if you did a really good job of disclosing and you did a sponsored video and you're like, hey, Warner Brothers paid for this video, then if I watched that video, I would, you know, kind of think, all right, like, so I'm going to remember that that happened, I guess. And like, see, you know, that is, that'll kind of inform my take on this person. But then if I've, the person continually recommends games that I really like too, and they seem to really get it. And like every time they're playing a game that I think is cool, they're really explaining why. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, I totally agree. Like, I like that game too. Like, I'm not going to care at all, because they're, you know, they surely have biases, and maybe those biases are related to financial stuff or other stuff. But when it comes down to it, what matters more is just the kind of relationship between the person on the one side of YouTube and the viewer. And that,
well, you know, that's why YouTubers, I mean, you were talking before about how YouTubers have that reputation of being like this new, like, most trustworthy, more trustworthy than the games press. That's because people see them directly and can trust them more,
sure,
than they might like reading a website and just seeing someone's byline, or like not even paying mm-hmm. attention to their byline and just paying attention to the review scores or whatever. So that's a,
yeah,
big part,
I mean,
of
I
it.
Think that people do also do that for written, you know, written reviews and
no, yeah, some people definitely do, especially I think Kotaku readers more than other sites tend to remember specific names and like know who we are. Mm-hmm. But I think that's by nature, because our site is designed to facilitate that and like to make it clear who we are, and we all show our personalities. But I think at other places, especially sites that might use freelancers for reviews, people don't necessarily know who's writing it, and so they just think of them as like the institution involved. Mm-hmm. And that has its pros and cons, a lot of cons. I think people are more inclined to trust some YouTuber who they see every day than like a faceless institution.
It's kind of, and which is good, I think, like trust individuals, not institutions, makes sense. And it's kind of funny actually that, or like darkly funny, that a lot of this is based around institutions figuring out how to get individuals to like co-opt individuals yeah. and get them to earn trust on their behalf. Which is very, like,
well, that's the
very,
thing. That's what makes those advertisements even more valuable, because they're being yeah. spoken. Like, if Warner well, Brothers is paying someone who you trust to talk about Shadow of Mordor, then, like, I mean, yeah, it's scary, because it's, like, I don't know. I find it hard to, like, really judge, because I've never been a YouTuber or, like, never been in that world or known how they make money and how hard it is, et cetera, et cetera. And I know it's really hard to do, even... Man, doing a weekly podcast is exhausting, let alone like yeah. talking on YouTube for 8 hours a day every day.
Yeah.
But
and I mean, and you mentioned sponsored posts, but there like sponsored posts are the same concept. Like, it's the big difference is the one you said, which is that we don't write the sponsored right. posts, which is a really important distinction, and one that's like a very hard line at I would imagine most, you know, major publications. But that is the same idea. Like, it is buying that sort of extra credibility of space on the site, which does feel to me like a like blurring of the lines and something that's like questionable and makes me, you know, like, I don't, it's a way to make money, and I think it's important to keep the lights on, but I, you know, it's all part of that same machinery that sometimes feels like institutions and large corporations are more and more infiltrating the spaces and like co-opting the trust and the institutional trust and the individual trust that people have, and using it to profit, which, you know, also, again, like you said, I think one of your big questions is, like, does anyone even care? Like, is this just something, like, maybe no one cares. Like, maybe people are like, whatever, it's video games. Like, if the game looks cool, I'll be able to
no,
tell.
No, that's definitely, a lot of people care. The question but, is yeah. whether the people who are watching YouTube care. Like, a lot of Kotaku readers have been interested in this and cared about it and written lots yeah. of comments and
sure.
given lots of feedback about it. The question is whether, like, your average 13-year-old who's, like, a huge fan of some YouTuber, like, I don't know who all the popular YouTubers are, but some Minecraft YouTuber or whatever, do they care or even know what it means if that YouTuber is being paid by a company to right. talk about right. something? That's and will they care when they grow up? And I don't know. These are questions without easy answers.
And actually, speaking of questions without easy answers, we didn't really answer all of Rob's questions, but I would say big like, as to the Warner Brothers thing and to the bigger question of YouTube, there definitely needs to be more reporting. We're doing it, you know, we only have so many people, but like, we report on YouTube. But I think that, yeah, in general, I think there's a lot of stuff, interesting stuff, not just scandalous stuff, but all kinds of stuff happening on YouTube. But also, this stuff does need more reporting, and there can be more follow-ups. And, you know, it's an ongoing story that has had a recent development. And so I at least agree that we need more coverage of it. I don't have a good answer for why there hasn't been, other than that this stuff is hard to report on, and it requires like actual investigation, and you need people to talk to you, and you need to like really nail down your facts. Some things are hard to track and keep track of. It's not easy work, but I think that I hear what Rob is saying in terms of like, this is kind of a story, and this whole realm of the internet deserves more coverage and should be looked at a little bit more closely. And that's true. I think it's,
yeah, I mean, it's also one of the reasons it's not covered that much is because it's been long been kind of accepted common fact that YouTubers get paid for various forms of coverage, like that influencers, quote unquote, are flown out to game studios all the time to play multiplayer games and make videos about them. And this is just something that it's like become the status quo. This was a particularly unusual case because the FTC got involved and slapped Warner Brothers around a little bit. But usually this stuff happens invisibly.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
All right, let's do one last question. I think we have time for one last one.
All right, this one's you.
Yeah, so Edwin says, "Hi, Jason and Kirk. Great work on Kotaku Split Screen and killer new intro music, Kirk. I was wondering if you could talk some inside baseball on how you go about reviewing a game and putting together a review. Things like game percent completion, review word count, etc. I've been reviewing games for a bit, and would like to hear about how you go about putting them together." Kirk.
Man, if you want to ask me a question, just begin by complimenting my saxophone playing. Mm-hmm. That'll always make me want to answer your question. Okay, some inside baseball. Well, so the first thing I do when I'm reviewing a game is I read over the agreement I've signed with the publisher for how much they're paying me for like what I can talk about and what I can't talk about. So that's the most important thing. No, I'm just kidding. That has never happened. I don't know. I guess I play the game and then I write what I thought of it. That's the extremely basic version. So we'll start there.
What people might not know is that we don't really have any sort of like specific rubric that you have to fill out, or like there's no specific guidelines for reviewing something at Kotaku. Like, you could review something in the form of a poem if you wanted to. You could write a haiku about a game and that would be your review. The only thing that we have that you would need for a Kotaku review is our review box.
Right.
Just like filling in the basics, the pros, the cons, how long you played.
So it is technically possible that you could play the first 10 minutes of a game, write a Kotaku review in poetry form, and then just publish that.
No, I don't think so. I think Steven had a requirement that like you have to finish a game. Our requirement was always like you have to finish or at least make a good effort at finishing a game.
Yeah.
Play enough to thoroughly understand it. I think if you've played 20 hours of a game and it's really bad and you know it's really bad and not going to get better, then you don't really have to finish it. I think it's more important to finish a game if you like it, because there could be something at the end that really changes your opinion, than it is if you don't like it. Because if you don't like a game for 20 hours and then the last 10 hours are incredible, it's still going to be a bad game. If you really like a game for 20 hours and the last 10 hours are terrible, then it's suddenly a way different type of game.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in general, it's interesting. I've thought about that from both sides, because there's also the fact that when I don't like a game and review it, I actually feel much more like I want to be really sure about everything I'm saying, because, you know, generally speaking, if you're going to go after a game, you're going to say you didn't like it, you want to be pretty solid on why, just if only because people tend to react more strongly to negative reviews, especially if they liked the game. And you don't want to be the person who wrote a bad review of a game complaining about a system that you actually missed something on, like that, you know, oh, like they're like, there are factual errors in your review.
Yeah.
Because gamers of all people will latch onto that extremely quickly and go after you for it and basically be like, your opinion is now invalid because you complained about this thing without knowing that you can actually go into the menu and you can toggle this one setting to do that thing. And you're like, okay, I still think this game is garbage, but like, you're right about that one small thing.
I mean, you're saying that, hold on, but if that's like a core complaint in your review, review, then it's
oh, yeah, then that's true. Then you did a bad job. And it hopefully one small thing like that wouldn't be, but yeah.
So I've seen that happen in reviews and gotten really – I've actually gotten read reviews that like complain of games I enjoyed that complained about this thing that they totally didn't understand, and it really pissed me off. So I get why people would be really upset about that.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not – I'm really not saying that it's not deserved, but I'm more saying that when – I'm playing a game that I really don't like and I'm planning to give a bad review to, I'm actually more likely to finish it and to play a lot of it and to really be like, okay, I'm going to really thoroughly understand why I don't like this and really put it through its paces, because I don't, you know, I don't want to just go and slag off some game that like undeservedly, and I want to be really sure about that. Whereas sometimes when a game is really good, it's usually very obviously good, and you play the whole thing and you're like, okay, this is like really good, I'm really having fun for all these reasons.
You've never played a game that's really good and then just like has a shitty ending or like changes things up in a way that leaves a sour taste in your mouth?
I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I can't think of any, but I'm sure there have been.
I think of one.
Yeah, I think that's more likely. Well, I know Bravely Default, right?
That's what I was going to say, If I hadn't played that entirely, if I had played like the first four chapters of that game, which is like a solid 25 hours, and then been like, this is great, I'm going to review it, then I would have been like totally like fucking up, like doing a disservice to readers, writing a fucked up review. Like that's the type of game. And I wonder how many, I didn't read any other reviews for that game, but I wonder how many people reviewed it without actually getting far enough to see the end bullshit.
I wonder. I think of any like serious sort of credible reviewers, especially credible JRPG reviewers, I highly doubt anybody did. And I think, yeah, like in general, like I joke about playing 10 minutes and doing a poetry review, but really like with Kotaku reviews, 19 times out of 20 we finish the game. It's very rare if the game is finishable. I mean, sometimes you're reviewing Overwatch
or No Man's Sky.
Overwatch. Yeah, or No Man's Sky. You're just reviewing it forever because the game goes on forever.
Well, is there a point? I guess there. We still know so little about that game. Is there like an actual? The point is supposedly to reach the center of the galaxy.
That game will be a good. It'll be a good test and sort of example of what Edwin is asking about, which is like there'll just be a point, I think, playing No Man's Sky where it'll be like, okay, I get it. Like I can speak to what this game does well and badly, and like you know, like look at a game like Destiny where. Or The Division more recently was this way, where you can review the game, and like my Division review is very open-ended, sort of a frustrating review to write in some ways, because I was like, well, this game does some things very, very well. It appears that the people developing it have a good head on their shoulders and are updating the game quickly, but it's impossible to say what it'll be like. And actually, down the road, they kind of screwed the game up in some ways. And like, big picture, The Division is kind of a disappointment now, all this time after it came out, where Destiny was kind of the reverse situation, or it went up, there were ups and there were downs. And like, you just can't account for that. So I'm increasingly willing to just leave that stuff ambiguous in a review, like of a game like that, because what else can you do? But say, here's what it is, here's what I think of it, here's how it works, here's what you'll get if you buy it right now, and then just kind of, you know, impart some understanding of it and leave the door open for further coverage, the idea being that you're going to keep covering this game over the months to come.
Yeah.
And that will form the kind of ultimate opinion of the game.
I think something that we have, that we are very lucky to have at Kotaku, is that we don't have any pressure internally or externally to hit embargo and make sure we hit embargo, which is what happens a lot of. So what happens with a review, with a game review, is the publishers, at least if a publisher has a good relationship with your website, they'll send you an early copy of the game so you have time to review it, and then they'll set an embargo when you can post your review. And the reason that's done, that's not a bad thing. The reason it's done is so nobody's rushing to get their review up as quickly as possible, and that so everyone in the press is kind of on the same playing field and can get their review up. But oftentimes it'll be like you get the game a week before it comes out and 5 days before the embargo, and so you're expected to finish it in 5 days, which is something that we rarely try to do.
If it's a situation like that, definitely.
We don't like
almost every time
reviews.
Not,
I can't imagine it. So we're lucky in that we don't have like I think at some sites there's kind of this pressure to hit embargo and they kind of have to.
I've even felt that pressure, not even from Steven or anything, but just you feel the pressure of knowing there are going to be articles about this game out. Like, people are going to start voicing their opinions at this specific hour on this day. Yeah. And, like, I would like to have an opinion by then because, you know, people are going to want to know. Everyone's going to be talking about it.
Well, but so what we'll do sometimes is post, like, an impressions piece if we haven't finished the game yet, and then save our official review for later on.
Which has got its own problems, as we've kind of identified over the years of doing this.
Right, because you're writing similar things to what you have written in your review.
And it sort of sucks when your first published opinion about a game is like temporary. It feels, you know, you really kind of, it's really nice to have your review be your like first and like strongest word on the game. And then you kind of cover it from the review instead of kind of being like, here are some bullet points of things I think I'll have more in the review. It depends on the type of game, but yeah.
It would be nice if publishers could get us games way earlier. I mean, it depends on the publisher, right? So some publishers are really good about getting us games like even up to, I've gotten games up to a month in advance. I think we talked about this on the show before. I remember saying that Atlas sends us games really early. Like, I've gotten Atlas games 2 months in advance. Hopefully they do that for Persona 5 and send us copies.
Or Sony, actually. Sony is generally very good about sending games out pretty early, a few weeks early.
Nintendo has always been good, too. About that.
And then there are just games that come where you're like, we're getting it a day before it comes out, and there's just nothing you can do. Like, you got bumped down on the list for some reason, and other people have it, and you don't, and you're kind of like, oh, we need to play it. And that's when it's very easy for me anyway to just throw my hands up and say, okay, I don't care. Like, get it to me when you get it to me. I will write about it as soon as I can, and like, you know, just go with God.
Well, hopefully, No Man's Sky comes at least a few days early.
Hopefully. That's definitely going to be one that might take a little while to cover just because of the size of it.
Yeah.
Hopefully people will be okay with that. We can also just stream it some. It's one nice thing, actually, about streaming and video with game reviews is if you're working on a review, like if I'm head down in a really intense review playing the crap out of a game, we can always just, it's nice on the, when the embargo is up or when the game is out, someone else at our site can just stream it for an hour on the site and be like, hey, here it is. If you just want to see it, like, we're going to have our whole big critical take on it in a minute. But for now, I'm just going to play an hour and you can watch us
play it. I guess so. But I also feel like with a game like that, it would be a disservice not to have written impressions on the day it comes out.
Well, I guess it'll depend. I mean, that could be true, but what if we get the game the day before it comes out, then it would be a disservice to write rushed written impressions.
No, I don't think so. I think something that could be like, and by the way, this is like our real-time discussion.
Yeah, we're actually talking about how we're going to figure this out.
Because I think you and I are both getting codes. So I would say that, first of all, it could be, since both of us are getting it, it could be a situation where one of us writes day one impressions and one of us writes a review.
Yeah, which is a luxury and can be a good way to do it.
That's true. And maybe we should do that with Final Fantasy 15 too, although I guess it depends when that actually arrives. But with No Man's Sky, it could be like a diary of like the first 3 hours of the game, and that's our day one thing. And then we do the review like whenever we feel comfortable enough to review it. But I think it's like readers are coming to Kotaku expecting to see something that isn't a stream, something that's written about No Man's Sky in the day, at least on the, like, not even embargo. I'm not worried about embargo as much as I am the day that it comes out and people want to know like what we think of it.
And I think it's extremely rare that we'll not have that on Kotaku, not something or other. I think maybe the most important thing that's like the big picture thing from all of this is just that you have to be flexible. Like, if you're doing it, there are going to be circumstances. Every game is different. Every timetable is different. And you just have to be flexible and kind of think, okay, what's the best way we can get the best information on the site in the easiest way that allows us to do it well and not rush through the game? You know, you kind of have a few questions that you answer and then just be flexible each time and make sure you're doing it right.
Yeah.
It's fun, though. I'll always like reviewing games. I really like writing game reviews. It's a very fun thing to do. So that's my other thing about reviewing games is it's important that it be fun, like that you actually like do it, like sitting down and like writing a game review is very fun for me. Like, I just like getting lost in the work and like getting creative and trying to come up with cool ways to describe what a game does well or what it does badly. Like, and that's an important thing just in general, is to kind of always be having fun with it.
Yeah. Do you find, this is something someone brought this up in the Kotaku Q&A we did the other day. Do you find that you like enjoy a game more or you enjoy it less when you have to play it for many hours straight to review it and like you're on a time crunch? Because it's something that can go either way, right? It's like something I've thought about a lot, whether I enjoy whether I enjoy a game more when I'm playing it marathon style, which I think I do, then like some people are like, oh, I'm so sick of this game after playing it hours on end. But for me, it's like I convince myself subconsciously that I like a game maybe even more than I actually do because I have to spend all this time with it.
I think that happens. I think that it's, for me, it's actually when there's a game that I really like that I'm reviewing, it's less that I enjoy it more because I'm playing it constantly. It's that if I really like a game, I'll play it really constantly anyways. And all of the games that I really truly love, I've played more than once. And it's almost always on that second time through, which is much more leisurely, and I'm not on any time frame or review budget or time budget, whatever uh-huh. the phrase is. Like, I'm playing on my own time, and I've played it before, so I'm not worried about spoilers, and, like, I know what can happen and what's going to happen. I know how the systems work. That's actually when I really love a great game, like any of the great games that I've really loved. It's that second time through, which sounds crazy, because I know most people don't have time to play games the first time through, but for me, really, that's
well,
the big difference for me.
Well, you play games all day instead of working.
Like, oh, right, yes, of course. That narrative again. I think that's the thing for me. And actually, like, even if I'm not reviewing a game, if I start it and it's really good, I'll like play it really hard and really fast and finish it, and then usually play it again down the road and still have that same feeling even if I wasn't reviewing it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that we should wrap things up.
Yeah, that was long. We still have more questions we'll have to hit next
week.
Yeah,
we'll
have to
hit them next time. So just a reminder, if you want to reach us, you can send stuff to splitscreen@kotaku.com. We've been bad about doing reader questions at the end of every episode, but we're going to try to start doing it more for future weeks. I'm so glad this is our last episode of July. July is over. Fuck off, July.
See you later, July.
Shitty July is finally going away. What else? You guys can leave us nice ratings. Please leave us nice ratings and reviews, because it helps us a lot with promotion and whatnot. If you like the show, share it with all your friends. Tell them to come get to know Jason Schreier and Kirk Hamilton, your new best friends.
That seems good to me.
I think that's about it. Any final thoughts, Kirk?
No, I think that'll do it.
All right. I will see you next week.
Yep. See you later.
Thank you.